Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
I believe this will not destabilize our economy. This is a fair and equal tax, one that all citizens and visitors to our states will participate in.
In Arizona, almost three decades of annual tax cuts, mostly the income and property taxes, have caused an increased reliance on the state sales tax. That's to fund our priorities. That's a fact.
All wedding invitations that the studio creates contain celebratory text about the wedding, period. So that is a fact that we all agree on. And that is enough for this court to say you can't compel that message.
Once Brush & Dip has decided to offer a particular type of invitation to the general public, the one thing it can't do is when somebody calls making a request, they can't have the sole test of whether they're going to make the invitation be, what sex is your fiance?
You must let the public vote on this matter. If you go ahead and pass it, you're crossing a line, and it's equivalent to a bloody act of violence against the public.
And with us to talk about a proposal to ask Arizonans to raise our taxes to pay for education, the Phoenix City Council approving a renovation deal for the Suns Home Arena, and more, are Julie Earfley of Earfley Uncuffed and Paul Bentz of High Ground. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
So, Julie, let's talk a little bit about this proposal from State Senator Sylvia Allen, which would expand the current tax that we pay, the sales tax. It's right now 0.6 cents. She would raise it to a full penny per dollar of sales tax to pay for education. And it seems as though the conversation is basically, this is more money than we have now, or it's still not enough money than we have now. What's your sort of sense of how this might play out?
I would say the latter. This isn't enough money. I mean, we have a situation where I think we have a lot of voters that are fatigued with this idea that education needs more money. We still haven't filled in the gap from the recession, and yet we have a proposal that still doesn't do that. And so we have this idea that we're going to have this big campaign for voters to pass this, and still we're going to be lacking. We need a vision. We need bigger dollars, and we need to be honest with voters. This is not going to get us to pre-recession funding. This is really only going to get K-12 education a couple hundred million more, and we need a lot more than that. This isn't going to take us to average national pay on teacher salary. This isn't going to do much to address overcrowded classrooms. Let's have a bigger discussion. This is just very small ball.
Paul, do you see this as a first step, as a big step, as a regular step?
I think it's huge that you have a rural Republican pointing out that we need more money for education and actually offering up a tax increase to fund it. I think it is clear that from all of our polling, we've seen education is the number one issue facing the state. People believe the schools are underfunded, want more money in the classroom. So this is a first step. It's a lot of hard work, whether it be for 0.4 cents and going and fiddling around with Prop 301 or some other larger funding source. It's almost the exact same amount of work for less money than I think is really needed.
Well, let me ask you about the fact that, as you referenced, Sylvia Allen is the person behind this, and she is not a moderate Republican. She is very, very conservative and somebody who in general would not be in favor of tax cuts. What is the significance, do you think, that she is the one pushing this?
She's a conservative Republican from the White Mountains, has not been a fan of tax increases in the past. I think it shows that even Republicans are aware that there are major funding issues when it comes to education. And despite the 20 by 2020 plan to give teachers a 20% raise, there's still significant funding issues. But I think they're trying to offer a solution to try to preempt other people from coming forward with solutions.
What about this paired with the money that was allocated for this within the governor's budget? I mean, does that add up to enough in general, Julie?
No, it doesn't. We're talking about trying to get back to pre-recession funding when really the discussion should be, how do we get to a place where we're at least at average funding for teacher salaries? I mean, I think that's a bigger discussion that we should have. How do we get to a place where we're moving forward? We're not just trying to catch up with the past. And so this is just, again, this isn't a vision. And I think we need to be honest with voters. We need to say we are greatly, vastly underfunding our public schools. Here's what it's going to take to get us to that average point, and just be upfront and honest about it. Otherwise, we're going to have nothing but these really small proposals, and we're going to tell voters over and over, this is the solution, this is the solution, and then you end up with voter fatigue, saying when is enough enough?
Is there some value, though, in maybe doing it incrementally? I know when you're talking about education, students are going through schools every year. You never want to say, okay, this class of kids, sorry, you know, the next one after you is going to get the money that it needs. But is it possible in one fell swoop, do you think, for the state to come up with all of the money that it needs? Or is there maybe value to doing, you know, taking this step now and then maybe doing something else next year and over time, hopefully not too many years, but getting up to where the state needs to be?
Yeah, the problem is this isn't really that incremental change in that you're already holding it off until 2020. So if you want to make some incremental change, then the legislature has the power to do that right now. They could do that in this session, and they're not doing that. Instead, they're proposing this big campaign. And to do this big campaign, they're going to have to do what they did with Prop 123 and many other education campaigns prior to that by sort of positioning it as this is how we save our schools. And then you get to this point where voters do get very fatigued and they say, how much is enough? So let's be honest, this is how much we need. And then let's go after that. And if you're saying this is one of several steps, then come out and say this is one of several steps. But I don't think you're positioning it that way. And I think that that's the difference, right? You've got Republicans saying this is what's going to get us to where we need. And you've got Democrats saying, absolutely not, this isn't enough.
Well, I guess when you're talking about voter fatigue, you have to throw bonds and overrides in there as well that appear on ballots in different districts.
There's about 30% of the electorate that say, you know, there's enough money in the schools if they just tighten their belt, and it's a bottomless pit. No matter how much money you put into it, they're always going to ask for more. So you have to overcome that. But as long as people can still go to Nevada or across the border to New Mexico or California to see $10,000 to $15,000 increase in their teacher pay, we still faced a major problem, and they've got to do something about it. When Prop 123 was passed, they promised us 4, 5, and 6 in the next step. So that was that. This is the first step down the road. It's just sort of this incremental little bites at the apple that come around, not addressing the larger problem.
And we've heard from David Lujan, from the folks behind the Invest in Ed initiative, which didn't make the ballot, or it got not it got thrown off the ballot, I guess, that they're not happy with this, that this is not enough. Here's my sense. So what if they, as they've said, the legislature doesn't come up with enough money, they don't put forward a plan that they think is sufficient, they might put this back on the ballot. Do we end up with dueling education initiatives?
I think we definitely could. And I think that I think that's more of a risk for Republicans, to be quite honest. And the other thing that we have to take into consideration is that the governor came out and said that he was opposed to Senator Allen's legislation. And so I think that that's significant as well, because you don't even have buy-in from the governor. And I don't know about the business community. They've really remained silent. So where is the buy-in to Senator Allen's initiative? I don't see it right now. I think that there is, however, buy-in for a resurgence of Invest in Ed.
Paul, how significant is the governor's opposition to Senator Allen's measure? Obviously, he doesn't have to go to him for a signature, go right to the ballot, but does that matter?
Education folks are quick to point out that statewide education funding initiatives have never passed without the support of the governor, and I think that's an important note. I think there's other things that contribute to it. It certainly could pass. The other thing is there's a difference between not supporting and active opposition. And so the question is, would the governor actively oppose an education funding plan, or does he stay out of the way? The bigger challenge I think that you're going to run into is this proposal also monkeys with Prop 301 and changes some of the funding. And that's there's some benefits to 301 that come along with it, but there's also drawbacks when they did the auditing and saw some challenges with 301. I don't know why you wouldn't do a clean proposal for either, say, teacher pay or something else separate from 301. I don't know what you get by merging it with that proposition.
All right, so let's talk about another pretty important bill that was heard in a Senate committee yesterday. This has to deal with early voting. We talked about it last hour on the show. And basically, the measure says that if you are on the early voting list and you get an early ballot in the mail, you must return it in the mail. You have to put it back in your mailbox. You cannot drop it off at a polling place anymore. Paul, we saw a lot of that just a few months ago when people were mailing their ballots back at the last minute, dropping them off at polling places. And as a result, we saw results that took a little while to get out there. Did we actually see more of that happening, or were we just paying more attention to something that's been going on for a long time and races were maybe closer and more high profile?
600,000 ballots were dropped off on Election Day and counted after Election Day. It was about the same number as 2 years ago, but it's twice as many as 4 years ago, the last midterm election. So it is a major issue. The problem that you're facing with that, though, is Ever since the United States Post Office closed the Tucson office, all of Tucson's mail comes to Phoenix. And so that's why our mail is ground to a significant halt. That's why it takes a week to ballots to be returned. You can't count on – you got to give people an opportunity to drop off their ballot. That being said, I don't see why we can't scan – either scan the ballot or scan the envelope, at least know what's out there on election day. That seems a much more reasonable solution than a punitive solution that tries to disenfranchise folks.
Julie, do you think this would lead to fewer people actually turning in their ballots?
Yeah, I do. I think that there are a number of folks who they want to wait until the last minute to make some of those decisions. And I think for good reason, they have every right to do that. And they like the idea of dropping off that ballot at the polling place. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It doesn't, again, this is, you know, a solution in search of a problem. I think the thing that has happened now is that you've got Republicans who are going to have other Republicans very upset with them. Because as you saw in that testimony, you know, you had Yavapai County, the recorder there, who came out and said, listen, this is going to disenfranchise a lot of our Republican voters. So it just doesn't make much sense. I'm not sure why they're going forward with this. I think there's going to be a lot of blowback from a lot of people on both sides of the aisle.
So you offered us one idea there. What about some other solutions then in order to get these counted faster? It seemed like from the interviews that we were doing as these ballots were being counted at the end of the election, right after the election in November, this is kind of always how long it takes. It's just that we were really tight on a lot of these races.
Mm-hmm. I have a friend who is running for the school board. And on election night, she was losing, and then they counted some ballots, and suddenly she was tied, and then they counted some more ballots, and she was ahead, and then ultimately she lost. And that's a frustrating place to be when you don't know how many ballots are left. At a minimum, we should know there are 100 or 1,000 or whatever. You look at LD-28 in Arcadia or LD-18 in Ahwatukee. Like, we should know how many ballots are left to count so you can get an idea if the media can call a race or at least get an idea of the way things are going. That would at least at a minimum give us a chance. I think it's clear that the recorder and everybody did a good job counting the ballots. It just takes a while, mm-hmm. and we have to be patient, but there's got to be something to give the public some support behind that.
Is this just a matter of like we want what we want and we wanted it 10 minutes ago? I mean, that we're just so like instant gratification now that we can't wait? Because you think about it, like for the number of people who voted in this state, it took, what, a week after Election Day to count most, if not all, of those ballots, including some that were coming from, you know, other countries, if, you know, they're overseas voters and things like that. Are we just maybe too demanding of when we want results?
Well, that could definitely be a factor. I think the other thing that we had was a lot of media had jumped to conclusions on who was winning the races. And so because there was so much turmoil and because results kept changing so much and so significantly, that I think got a lot of voters very frustrated and upset. So I think we have to kind of take a little bit of onus in that regard by not saying, listen, there are still all of these uncounted ballots. We really can't call this race. But I think part of it is just giving voters sort of more of an indication, as Paul had said, like there are still these numbers of votes outstanding. And so we need to take a step back and not make some of these calls so quickly.
Yeah, we had a Dewey defeats Truman situation in the right. Corporation Commission race where the AP had called the CorpCom race and then it flipped. And every vote deserves to be counted. We do need to have a little bit of patience in this 24-hour news cycle, impatient society. But there's also things that we can do to bring some legitimacy to the process and allow people to have confidence that the government's doing the right thing when they count these votes.
That is Paul Benz of High Ground. Also with us is Julie Earfley of Earfley Uncuffed. You're listening to the Friday Newscap on the show. More conversation right after this. Welcome back to the Friday Newscap on the show here on KJZZ 91.5 with Lauren Gilger in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. We're joined in studio by Julie Earfley of Earfley Uncuffed and Paul Benz of High Ground. Guys, let's talk about something that happened kind of unexpectedly yesterday at the state capitol, which is that State Representative David Stringer, who I think most of our listeners will know, has made some pretty controversial statements with regards to race over the past several months. He apologized to his colleagues and kind of by extension, the public. Julie, were you surprised that he did this? I mean, the first time he was caught making some statements, he did kind of an apology. And then since then, it's been kind of radio silence from him. He won re-election pretty handily and hadn't really said all that much.
Yeah, I was surprised that he made the apology. It kind of came from nowhere, although my guess is that there were probably some folks behind the scene who were encouraging it. I think, unfortunately, there was some more information that came out today in the news about a previous conviction on child pornography.
In the 80s, he was living in Maryland, yeah.
Correct.
Phoenix New Times had that.
Right. And so I think basically what happened is that now this is going to remain in the news in a much bigger way. And I think the question is going to return, right? Should they expel him? Should he resign? These are very serious questions, and I think he needs to answer for them.
Well, Paul, that's kind of the question, right? Like, what should the legislature do? Speaker Rusty Bowers took away his committee and dissolved it. He took him off of other committees. Is this the kind of situation where lawmakers should do what they did last year with Don Shooter and vote to censure or expel him?
I think they'll look into that. I think the question is, are these two issues, him apologizing yesterday and the revelation today, connected, or are they not connected at all? Some folks yesterday, when I heard about the apology, some folks said it's because he wants to run for Congress because Gosar is going to run for the Senate. So who knows? I mean, there could be a whole wide variety of outcomes here that they're all looking at. He won handily after the comments the first time. I'm not sure that district wants a conservative. That district has proven time and again. But the legislature does need to look at it. They do need to look at these new allegations and come to some sort of decision, because they do have they need to be an honorable body and look at these things.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned how the question is, are they related or are they separate? Because I think for a lot of people at the legislature, there is concern about, you know, punishing somebody for what they think and what they say, even if what they think and say is abhorrent. Whereas if a crime was committed, that seems like it might be a totally different situation.
I think it's a very different situation. I think you've got sort of the thought police view of just somebody says something, should you kick them out of office, versus have they committed a crime, or is there something that basically renders them unfit for office? And I think this is the latter, and so they're going to have to explore that and see exactly what it was and come to some sort of decision, because the public is looking at them and they cannot protect their own in this situation if there's something there.
Is this a story that the Republican leadership in the state legislature would just like to go away and now is not going to? And then if that's the case, do they have to politically respond?
Likely. Yes, they do. I mean, I think, though, part of how they respond may be dependent on what happens with the constituents in his own district. There was talk a while back that there was a committee forming to do a recall campaign. Mm-hmm. Now, if that committee goes forward and if that forms, it may be that sort of relieves some pressure on the leadership and they say, well, let the constituents take care of it. But I think as we learn more about these past charges and what really happened, that will also play into what legislative Republicans do.
How do you guys think that Stringer should address this? Should he address these allegations? Or is this the kind of thing that, you know, he maybe hopes goes away or can issue a statement or something like that?
You know, I personally think he should resign, but I just don't think that him addressing these issues is going to matter, because every time he's issued a so-called apology, everybody has walked away saying, did he really apologize? I'm not really sure what he just said
there. Kind of defeats the purpose of apologizing if people aren't sure you apologize.
Exactly. So I don't think that he's making the case for himself every time he speaks up. I think we're going to have to wait and see what the public says, and particularly what his constituents are saying now that this new information has come to light.
All right. So another very odd situation that happened this week was that the Phoenix City Council chambers, the council was voting on the deal to renovate Talking Stick Resort Arena, where the Suns and the Mercury and the Rattlers play. And you had this situation where former county supervisor Mary Rose Wilcox testified. And then moments later, the guy who shot her at a county supervisor's meeting also testified, referencing violence. This was, I mean, we talk about bizarre things happening at the state capitol. This was bizarre, right?
It was crazy. It was crazy. And you have to wonder, like, was that even legal? Wasn't that a threat? I guess I'm still waiting to hear if there's any legal action that they can take against him. I know former Councilman Michael Johnson got up and he spoke and he said exactly that. Can we please review these tapes and find out if this was a threat? It was beyond crazy. And I think, you know, the council is going to continue to have a lot more issues now. There is a group that came out that apparently just formed that is going to try and put this issue on the ballot. So this issue is not going away. The Suns Arena, I think, is going to stay in the news for a long time to come.
Paul, it seemed as though support seemed to grow on this deal as more information came out, as the city sort of belatedly held those public meetings. There were some tweaks to it in terms of the Suns making some contributions to charity, things like that. Do you think there really is more support for this in the community now than there was the first time the council was slated to vote?
I think tweaks is a generous phrase for what they did. I think one thing that we should all take away from this is the Suns could have done this right the first time around. They could have done these public meetings. They could have done this negotiation with the council, probably same thing, but left with a better reputation. Instead, they tried to jam it through and then had to sort of play catch up and do sort of this public relations effort to really sort of smooth over the community. And they're not the other thing that's been pointed out is if they were playing well or if the team was good, this wouldn't have been a problem.
Or if they'd been playing well any time over the past decade.
Right. And exactly over the last decade, or if Sarver had been a better reputation, none of this would have been a problem, because I think most people agree the Suns are an economic driver and that they're critical for downtown. I think it comes down to the deal. And I mean, ultimately, they basically agreed to $10 million more to the community, including $2.6 million for Head Start preschool, $1.5 million going to the homeless and making sure that some of the revenue they generated went to public safety. That's all. There's no real big difference here. At the end of the day, they got a two-for-one deal where the city's paying more than half in an environment where most people aren't paying for stadiums anymore.
How do these things normally work? Is that out of the ordinary? And I guess since I don't know that, probably lots of voters don't know that. And if it does go to the ballot, how will people kind of weigh these things? Do you think it has public support?
Well, I think that there's been some talk recently. There's been some reporting about other deals that have happened in other cities where the teams have paid a lot more than the cities have. And so I think that you've got residents who are evaluating this deal based upon that. And they're saying what, dare I say, Councilman DeCiccio is saying, that, you know, this wasn't a great deal for the city of Phoenix. And I really think if this goes to a vote, I think there is a very high possibility that it gets defeated and that the entire thing is back on the table. And I don't think it was just the Suns that really wrecked their reputation or you know, defamed it slightly with this whole deal. I think it was the council members as well. They did a very poor job in understanding the angst that citizens of Phoenix feel when it comes to paying for an arena for a multi-billionaire. This is not something that they really wanted, especially when we are not flush with cash.
Pardon my pun, but that'll be a full court press if this thing goes to the ballot. But I don't think the money is there for the petition. It's one thing to say there's a petition. There's another thing to say there's a funded petition drive. I don't think it's there, but I think the Suns still have a lot to do in building their reputation back up.
All right. Well, unfortunately, have to leave it right there. That's Paul Bentz of High Ground. We're also joined by Julie Earfley of Earfley Uncuffed. Thanks, you both, for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.